Well, hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Danny Katz. Today, I am joined by me. I am solo podcasting. It has been a minute since I have put out a solo podcast, and I thank you for your patience in awaiting this episode. Before we dive in, I'm reminding you to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. Also, to click that subscribe button over there on Odyssey or on whatever podcast platform you're listening to. Your subscribing makes a big difference in terms of training the algorithm to give me more reach. So liking, sharing, commenting, all these things are really, really helpful. And I thank you for your efforts. Also reminding you, great news. My Pop Propaganda, one-of-a-kind digital media literacy homeschool course has dropped in compensation. I lowered the donation for this one-of-a-kind program that does not exist anywhere on the planet. No one else is teaching propaganda, media literacy, media manipulation to our teens. So I dropped it to the very affordable donation of $249. That gets you lifetime access to all 11 modules. Every module is super chock full, could probably be divided into two, making it a 22 module class. Anyway, register immediately at poppropaganda.com, learn more about it. You could also get to it through my website, dannykatz.com. I think that does it for housekeeping, though. I do want to start us off with an acknowledgement for those watching with our eyes that I am wearing rose-colored glasses today. I have worn colored lenses for several years, and it has nothing to do with how I am being met or received by the outside world. It really only has to do with how I'm choosing to see the world and lining myself up accordingly. I'm currently transmuting some sort of imbalance in my eyes. So the reason I'm wearing these glasses today is a public service to you to not have to see what is happening underneath here. I will save you from going into the details. And I bring it up because it is relevant to today's topics. Because I once saw Jerry Seinfeld when he had his show Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, which I actually thought was fantastic and really entertaining. And the gist of the show, for those who have not seen it, is Jerry, who I guess is like a vintage car lover, would get a different vintage car and go pick up a different comedian, and then they would just go to like a cafe or a coffee house and just like chat and shoot the poop, as it were. And in one of them, I believe he was in Portland, and he saw a guy who was wearing orange colored lenses. And Jerry said to whomever he was with, I don't remember who that was, but he said, oh, it's so pretentious, that guy in his glasses. He was just disgusted by it. And as someone who does wear color therapy glasses, I was a little taken aback by the judgment. And I get it. Humans are a judgy species. But I thought that that particular assessment was a little bit of a reach. Like, just because someone is choosing to see the world through tinted lenses, how does Jerry then discern that that makes them pretentious? So I looked up the definition of the word pretentious. I will read it to us now. Now, granted, this is via DuckDuckGo. I haven't like gone super deep into like Cambridge or the etymology or anything, but just high level definition of pretentious. Claiming that or behaving as if one is important or deserving of merit when such is not the case. And so, like, obviously, Jerry was speaking to his own insecurities, right? And his own lack of confidence in choosing to wear color therapy glasses, which is neither here nor there. If you don't want to wear color therapy glasses, ain't no thing. But that projection of someone thinking that they're better than other people for wearing colored lenses is just such a crazy, kooky leap. And this is really very topical for the various things that we're talking about today. But like noticing one of the main ways that we do one another as a human species a disservice and insert more and more separation and ill will into the social sphere is by projecting intention onto other people's behavior that either confuses us, we don't understand, challenges us, triggers us, makes us uncomfortable, which clearly was the case with Jerry seeing a guy wearing color therapy glasses. But to make the leap and say that's pretentious, is kind of nuts. And this is an issue I've had with the word pretentious as a word nerd anyway, is rarely do we have enough information as to someone else's internal experience to make the assessment that they're acting pretentious. Now, if they're saying like I'm better, or offering any other indicators, I think pretentious might be more aligned. But in my mind, it's like inextricably bound now with that episode of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee and Jerry making this like completely insane leap of illogic and projecting his own insecurity and I guess inferiority complex onto this stranger who, in Jerry's mind, made the egregious affront of wearing orange lenses out into the world, and Jerry Seinfeld deciding and sharing on national, international television that that means that that person thinks they're better than everyone else. So I know that I'm dealing with like a much higher level of psycho-emotional intelligence with you guys, or we wouldn't be hanging out together like this. But just to be clear, I am not wearing pink glasses because I think I'm better than anyone. I'm wearing pink glasses because I have something happening with my eyes that is unsightly and kind of gross and kind of distracting. And I'm trying to keep all of us focused and save you if you have a delicate belly the way I do, just so you don't have to see it. So I wanted to get that out of the way. These, by the way, I'm not sponsored by Rainbow Optics on any level, although what a great idea. But I do get my colored lenses from Rainbow Optics. They are my favorite of the companies. They used to have all sorts of like different shapes, and I think they've kind of whittled it down, which I've noticed everyone doing in these past few years. And I don't know if that's like a post-COVID economy choice, supply chain issue, what have you, but I like wearing color therapy glasses, not because I care at all about how I look or what other people are going to think of me, but because sometimes it's fun to put like a different shade or tint on my own experience of reality. And I've always elevated and prioritized my experience of reality over how other people are going to perceive slash judge me. And I really encourage all of us to do the same. It's way more fun that way. Pausing for a quick sip. It's morning here. I'm still getting my just right caffeine alchemy going. All right then. So, we're gonna take our time today if for no other reason than it just feels so much better to move slowly. I am just back from a week of camping in the Sonoran Desert where I was at Primitive Skills Camp, and it was a really cool experience in terms of having the opportunity to learn so many skills from so many survivalist experts. I learned about making knots, making fire, making shelters, water, weaponry. And but something came up in one of my knots classes that I'm inspired to share. So the class was being taught by a woman who I guess she's pretty well known in that survivalist space, and it's not my space. So, caveat, I pretend no expertise. And apparently there's some show where they like drop people by themselves in the middle of nowhere and they have to figure it out. And she was one of the people on one of these shows. Anyway, all this is to say is like she really knows her stuff, and I loved her class. So I mean no disrespect whatsoever, but as she was kind of giving the intro into knots, she was talking about there being a mathematical formula for knots that translates, you know, that there's like this abstract mathematical formula, and then a scientist proved, you know, in real life working with rope that they correlate. I hope that made sense. In telling the story, she said, you know, there's this mathematical formula, and a woman scientist is the one who ultimately proved it. And when she said woman scientist, every cell in my body went, ugh, why would you say that? Why did you have to toss in that caveat that it was a woman scientist? Because when she tossed in that caveat, it operated on a number of levels. So the first was it was completely fragmenting and took me out of the flow of not learning. When I talk about fragmentation, I'll often use the comparison of a needle scratching on a record. Like it like totally disrupts the flow. We were talking about knots, and then all of a sudden, this like sexist bigotry was dropped into the equation, and I found it totally distracting because all of a sudden I was being told, as a woman, you're a second-class citizen. You're a disempowered victim, and you're such a disempowered victim that I need to virtue signal and remind you that you're a disempowered victim by inserting this into a conversation when it's really off topic and has nothing to do with what we're talking about. And it's so freaking insulting, as though female scientists haven't been making important discoveries for, I mean, I would say decades, but it's centuries and eons. Because let's go back to like Alexandria, let's go back to like ancient Greece and Egypt and the Middle East and the Iberian Peninsula before this narrative, this like, you know, PSYOP was foisted upon humanity that women were second-class citizens, because back in the day, before that particular PSYOP, that wasn't a thing. And, you know, we have Hypatia, who, you know, ran the Library of Alexandria, and we have other like badasses in the Essenes where they didn't have these like sexist delineations that apparently we're still moving through. I thought we moved through them after first wave feminism, but then Tavistock got its grubby hands on it and decided to use feminism as a means of keeping women down under the auspices of privileging women. It's all a big giant shell game. But so first of all, the insertion of discovered by a woman scientist as though woman scientists haven't been making great discoveries for our entire lifetime, right? So just that right there was like, ew, why would you put that in? Think of it this way. What if she said, which was discovered by a black scientist, which was discovered by a gay scientist, which was discovered by a Jewish scientist? Like all of these adjectives, these identity construct laden adjectives only weaken the entire statement. So it, like I said, it's operating on so many levels. So let's just talk about the adjectives for a moment. I've mentioned before the law of mankind lawful class that I'm still in the process of finishing because I'm doing multiple law classes at the same time and a bunch of other things, and my process isn't necessarily the most efficient, but many needles are moved more slowly than if it was just one needle. Maybe it's a manifesting generator thing. And I mention this because in the Law of Mankind class, which I highly recommend, and I will always, well, I don't know if always, but you will find a link to register for that class in this show description because I'm just such a fan of it. And yes, full disclosure, I am also an affiliate. And I only affiliate things that I actually love and stand by and partake in myself. So if anyone from Rainbow Optics is watching, let's talk about sponsoring my podcast or setting up an affiliate situation. Anyway, in the Law of Mankind class, they go the distance to make it clear, don't add adjectives before your statements because it weakens them and it creates these like cracks and vulnerabilities for people who are not playing the lawful game, but the legal game, the legal commercial fiction game, can worm their way into those cracks and create conflict and controversy, right? Using the language of the Law of Mankind. So this is why in the Law of Mankind, they urge us not to say we're learning sovereign law, right? Because by saying we're learning sovereign law, it weakens the coherence of law and lawfulness, which doesn't require any adjectives in front of it. It just stands on its own. Lawfulness. Same with scientist, right? We don't need to delineate Latinx scientist, trans scientist, Hindu, Baha'i scientists, like all of that weakens the veracity and the frequency embedded in scientists. All we need to know is that scientists or a scientist ultimately proved that there's a mathematical formula for knots that correlates to the physical creation of knots. That's it. We don't need that extra virtue signaling identity stuff tossed in because it weakens the initial statement. So I just wanted to give us that piece on the adjectives. And I'm gonna do a little, I need to blow my nose. Let's pause while I blow my nose. Thank you. Okay, thank you for your patience. I'm keeping it at the ready. This has been the most interesting, actually, it's not really that interesting. I don't need to program you guys to think that that's interesting, but I myself am having an interesting reintegration back into altitude from being down at Sonoran Desert sea level, and it is clearly affecting the eyes, the nose, the whole situation. Isn't it fun being human and having a body and taking care of our physiology? Okay, so we did the adjective piece of it. Let's go to the virtue signaling victim piece of it. The only reason, and again, I mean zero disrespect to the woman who said this. She's awesome at what she does, right? And there are very few people who are examining language to this like nuanced nerd out degree that I am. So no harm, no foul. And it's just a larger commentary on this like degenerative, demoralizing victim identity op that I'm so clear was gifted to us by the Obama Axelrod administration and their like really gross propaganda techniques that did humanity such a grave disservice by dividing us to this extreme extent. And I will include the link in this show. I'm going to make a note right now to the article that really broke this down in a way that just confirmed my suspicions, right? Like when I looked back on like when did all of this gross divide and conquer identity stuff pop up? I did start to pin it to the Obama administration, but this article that I'm referencing just breaks it down and makes it super clear. Okay, so pre-2008, we weren't really hearing people say, well, a woman scientist decided, or this black-owned organic winery, this Valentine's Day, buy your chocolates from this trans chocolate store. Like that stuff was not happening because our country wasn't quite as racist or bigoted, right? We'd come so far beyond that by way of the 60s and the 70s and free to be you and me and Schoolhouse Rock and the Jeffersons and the Cosbys and like all the awesome things that helped us unite and unify. And then this like gross identitarian psyop was dropped in, and now we have well-intended people not realizing how sexist and bigoted and gross it is to say a woman scientist discovered this knot formula. Ugh. So the communication in that is that women are victims, which is alleging that women's are down. Like when we go to my hierarchy, litmus, right? It's really only these privileged classes, who are propped up by way of this linguistic bigotry tick. So it's reminding us, you know, those second class disempowered victims actually aren't as pathetic as you think, because they can figure out math, right? It's this weird, like, why are we even talking about the woman victim thing? I thought we were talking about knots. Like, I really just want to learn about knots, and I don't want to get into this whole like identity nonsense. And as a woman, I find it supremely offensive, and I am not easy to offend. To be put down as a victim class, because that's not anything that I buy into, and that's not something that I am willing to sign on to in my lifetime, wherein I have had the same amount of rights as men since I was born. Are there subtler degrees of sexism that can infiltrate different, realms of this matrix overlay? Sure. But the way to transmute them is not to double down and keep talking about them and whining about them and tethering ourselves to some sort of victim narrative and keep bringing it into the present moment and thus seeding our future with more of it. Like, that is absolutely the opposite of an effective way of transmuting any lingering sexism that, was left over, to say nothing of this new, like, ultra puffed up, contrived version that is just so tiring. So, identity. I'm gonna pull out the language of betterarchy and see if there's anything new to shed light on this. Oh, I just opened it to the language of identification. Wasn't even trying to, but let's see. I'm just gonna roll with it. Let's see what I had to say about the language of identification in the language of betterarchy, which is available now in print, ebook, and audiobook at your favorite online bookseller and at Fruit of the Earth if you're here in Santa Fe. And if you would like to see it at your local bookstore, I appreciate you requesting it and requesting that they stock it. That would be awesome. And as long as we're on the topic, if you have read The Language of Betterarchy and you have not yet left an Amazon review, I thank you from the bottom of my heart, for doing that today. Thank you. Okay. The language of identification. The language of identification delineates a class of words and phrases that foster attachment to ideas, experiences, archetypes, and avatars, which can engender suffering, division, fragmentation, and limitation. While I generally advise eschewing identification as much as possible, not every identity construct is necessarily deleterious. I didn't know this is where I was going to go, but let's just go with it. If identifying as a wordsmith has me feeling expansive and delightful, then the act isn't necessarily doing me a disservice. If, however, I'm being invited to volunteer on a cob building project and I defer to my identity as a writer as a means of dodging those more laborious tasks, now I'm out of integrity with the identity construct that I'm wielding as an excuse to separate myself from the endeavor slash mission. Ultimately, it's on us to choose which identity constructs are serving us and which ones are not, a task which invites us to hone in on the language of identification, which resources us to discern if and when identification is helpful and appropriate. All right. I didn't know that's what I was going to talk about, but we'll go there. So, Maybe for her, in that instance, it was empowering to remind herself that women aren't stupid losers and that women can figure out science. But as a teacher, it feels irresponsible because that feels like more of a personal hangup of hers, like Jerry Seinfeld's issue with color therapy glasses. But to project that out onto the class itself, and this is something teachers would be wise to learn, is like they're modeling for all of their students. So maybe she has hangups, and maybe they're appropriate from being in the survivalist community. I don't really know. I can't speak to that. But as a student in her class, I personally didn't appreciate the allegation that women are second-class citizens who need to be thrown a bone and given some sort of like affirmative action call out because this woman is still transmuting her own internalized insecurities about being a woman. It was gross. To me, I felt like it was gross. And I also feel like equal. I'm all about equal. So if we're gonna say, it's Black Appreciation Month, is Black History Month? Where's White History Month? Where's Chinese History Month? It's like, okay, if we're gonna say women own, black own, there was a women only fire making class. Is there gonna be a man only fire making class? Is there gonna be a gap tooth Jewish girl only? Like, how divided do we want to be? How much fragmentation are we going to create when it really is just we're all learning to make fire? Why is that a gender thing all of a sudden? Ballet, I've taken ballet my whole life, and most ballet classes are predominantly women, and it was always awesome when men would show up. Do we need man-only ballet? I get it as a marketing tool. I mean, you're creating more products and more audiences, but it is doing humanity like this giant disservice. And I think there's so much bigotry embedded in it. Like here in Santa Fe, I saw, this was maybe like a month ago, there was like a POC only dance party. It's like, that's so freaking racist. First of all, POC, people of color, that's the new lingo around it, I guess. But like, if I were an ADOS, African descendant of slaves, to be lumped in with like someone who emigrated here from Iran or the Philippines and has more melanin than say Scandinavian American, to be lumped in, it's like this eroding of that real deal cultural identity and just being tossed into this racist, melanated mix of brown people. Like, I can't even believe that our culture has devolved to this point. And then it's just weird to me when groups who are transmuting real deal, I don't even want to say real deal victimization because I don't want to keep that story alive, but basically, it's weird to me when Gen Xers sign on to this and like Gen Xers and above, where it's like, no, this doesn't apply to us. Like, we know better. We know that this is all a contrived bullshit game. So there's the part about this like putting women down. And in case you're new to my work, let me just explain very briefly. The future is not something over which we have no say, no creative agency, right? We are all creating the future now. The present moment that we are living in, there's like our shared reality construct, there's my own personal reality construct, there's your own personal reality construct. But these realities, these present moments are forged of everything we thought, said, and did in the past, right? Everything we thought, said, and did in the past is what seeded the way for this now moment. Everything that I am saying, thinking, and doing in this now moment is what is seeding the future. A lot of people are under the mistaken impression, thank you, nefarious social engineers, that the future exists of its own accord, right? Some Sky Daddy created this future, and we're just riding like a people mover to meet this future over which we have no agency, exists of its own accord, and then like will surprise us with how it shows up. That's not how it works. You and me and all of us are creating the future by what we are doing together now. So when I am taking an outdated victim story, oh, women didn't have the right to vote in 18, whatever, and I cling to it in the here and now, I am carrying that disempowerment and that inferior status into this now moment and seeding the future with those frequencies and those narratives, right? So we are all co-creating our now and our future by way of our every thought, word, and deed, which is why I am so adamant about leaving the past in the past, not digging our heads in the sand, or putting some cherry Mary sunshine, you know, like false mythology on top of it. We mine the past for the lessons, we make the adjustments, but we move forward guided by and bringing in the frequencies of that future that we are wanting to live, right? So if I'm wanting to live in a version of reality that is forged by equality, abundance, peace, unity, empowerment, joy, and fun, the only way that I'm going to realize and meet that future is by seeding my now with those frequencies, so that that is, you know, it's like the seeds that we're planting. If I want a future full of victimhood, then yes, I will plant more seeds of victimhood and disempowerment. But if I want the future that I just described, then that requires me to seed my now with those frequencies, which means not carrying these disempowered victim stories into the here and now, like this woman did with the not scientist. I just want to pause and see if there's anything else relevant in the identity section, because that language of identification piece was a little bit off topic. Well, let me just start at the beginning of the identity section. Separation consciousness arises out of identification and the seemingly benign act of attaching to labels, aspects, images, stories, and stereotypes. Identification happens when we lock into fixed notions of who we or others are and conflate choices, preferences, characteristics, behaviors, and beliefs with the self, aka the condition of being a specified person or thing. So I'm skipping ahead. The more we identify confusing aspects and allegiances, or even, you know, outdated histories with the self, the more fragmented we become and the more suffering we create. Why? Because attaching to an identity is the action that sets us up to suffer. One of the Buddha's primary teachings was that attachment is the root of all suffering. In a reality construct ruled by impermanence, attaching to anything is a setup for pain, loss, and frustration. Attaching an identity construct to any of the various ever-shifting aspects that coalesce to create our concept of self is to lock ourselves into a stagnant cage of our own forging and to set ourselves up for a great big bunch of suffering. When we grasp on to any one morsel of our infinite I/me-ness, or us/we-ness, or they/them-ness, or anything/everything-ness, and then go about crafting an identity construct around it, we become attached. This attachment creates what physicists call a quantum entanglement. And then I go into quantum entanglements. But the gist is like, in the instance of the not teacher, clearly she had an attachment to an identity construct as woman. And she not only had an attachment to the identity construct that was woman, but she also has an attachment to the story that women are persecuted, are marginalized, right? And that was what it was informing, that languaging in saying that this woman scientist made this great discovery. So by attaching to that identity construct, what she's doing is carrying an outdated history of women being treated as second-class citizens, and she's carrying that into the present moment and giving that narrative, that frequency, that setup, that identity more life in her reality construct. And by projecting that in her teaching, she was then foisting that upon all the people in her class, which is why me, being a student in her class, in my head said clear, cancel, delete. I was very well behaved at this retreat and made a point of not pushing back or smearing my opinions over everything or anything. I was just there to learn, not to be a quantum languaging Nazi. But this, I do want to emphasize this for teachers. Every word is programming technology. So when we're speaking to a group of people, this is the perfect example of not just how languaging is programming everyone we're speaking to, but this was when, like, an instance very similar to this is when I realized, in an experiential way, how one person teaching could program an entire room full of people. So, taking us back to 2007, I think it was, I just finished reading R. Neville Johnson's Hidden Language Codes, and I was at a talk given by a, we'll just say a coach. A coach was speaking to a room full of people. And she threw something down like this. It was like a throwaway line, but I remember it was specifically like, you'll never do X. Say it was like succeed unless you do this, which was like the thing she was selling. And I saw with my eyes those words, that limitation leave her mouth, and I saw it being absorbed and received by every person in the room. And I saw every person in the room, their empowerment, like, plummeting because they were ingesting and signing on to this program that was putting them down. This is the power that someone has when they're put in a position of so-called authority, right? Speaking to a group of people as a coach, as a teacher, as an expert, as a doctor, as a knot tying expert, whatever. And understanding the responsibility that the speaker has in how are we choosing to program the people that we're speaking to? Because every word is functioning as programming technology. Are we being responsible with that tool, with that power? This is the crux of what I'm teaching, is like, look, this woman was teaching about knots. She wasn't teaching about gender identity or gender equality or, you know, individualized empowerment. But what she did with that throwaway line was disempower every single woman in that gathering, in her class, by reminding them with one throwaway word, woman scientist, by reminding them, oh, hey, you guys are a second-class citizen. You guys are victims. And to combat your less than status, I'm gonna throw you a bone because you guys need me to throw you bones to bring you up to equal status because you're so disempowered and inferior and pathetic. That is how that little caveat functioned. Again, obviously, this was not intentional. Obviously, she had no idea that this is how that little caveat word was functioning and the effect it was having. It was havening. Apparently, my mouth just wants havening to be a word. But ignorance is not an excuse for disempowering an entire knot tying class. And this is why I'm excited for more of us to clue in to quantum languaging, the language of betterarchy, all of these things, so that we can consciously and deliberately use our words to empower, uplift, and unify in every single moment. This is, I talk about this a lot, that the beauty of understanding how language is functioning as reality programming technology is that we can change the world for the better with our every word. If this woman who was teaching the knot tying class had taken any of my webinars, let's say she took my super basic how to empower yourself in the world with your every word, which is available now through my website, or if she read Word Up, Little Languaging Hacks for Big Change, or the language of betterarchy, then she would have a different attunement to how her words were functioning and the danger of these throwaway identitarian caveats. And instead, she could have used her language to empower and uplift everyone in the knot tying class and bring us into a greater state of human unity instead of doubling down on the contrived gender divide, exacerbating it and making it wider and uglier and more damaging with just one throwaway word. The last piece about this, and this is like a, the most abstract, is how it's fragmenting. And I mentioned the needle on the record. So I say this pretty frequently, that it is the responsibility of the communicator to be understood. So if you and I are having a conversation and I'm speaking in some gobbledygook, references or metaphors, or using some highfalutin language that you don't understand, it's on me to re-language what I'm trying to communicate in a way that you can grasp. By the same token, it is most efficient for me to speak in a way that creates a momentum of coherence and harmony so that you and I can stay on topic without distractions or interruptions, right? Like right now, I'm recording a podcast. If all of a sudden the lightning alarms start going off on the golf course, which sometimes happens, that's going to create a distraction that will pull you away, or can pull you away from what I'm saying, right? Or if I'm speaking and I sneeze or the phone rings, right? These create interruptions, and then I need to bring it back on track. Momentum is such a valuable energetic frequency. I'm not sure if it's one of the Hermetic principle. Let me look it up. It might be. I want it to be the principle of momentum. No, but the momentum conservation principle is certainly a big piece of physics, right? Think of your car, right? And you're going and it's smooth, it's flow. Your foot is on the gas pedal only a certain extent. You stop, you have to start again from scratch. It's super inefficient, right? Think of restarting your computer, what a pain in the butt it is, or restarting your phone, right? We'd like, it's always more efficient to stay in that momentum, right? When I was learning to drive, my dad made a point of teaching me to stay at a pace where I could just catch the most green lights possible and not have to stop, start, stop, start, stop, start. So the same goes with communication. We want to stay on topic. Same goes with our attention, right? Anyone who's think of people who are addicted to social media, or we can distract ourselves with this or that when we're on a writing deadline, or even not on a writing deadline. Like any writer knows how alluring distractions are, but it's really when we can stay in the same topic and stay in the same task for as long as possible, when we have breakthroughs, when we tap into novelty, where things really start to cook, we start to make good connections, right? All of that is generated by momentum. The last thing we want to do is stop, start, stop, start, stop, start, pull ourselves out, needle on the record interruptions, right? So when I talk about fragmentation in the in terms of our languaging patterns, I'm talking about, you know, words and phrases that function as those needles on the record and pull us out of the topic at hand, pull our brain out of staying, you know, fully with the speaker, the writer, whatever it is. So in the instance of the not class, for me, that completely pulled me out of not class. And all of a sudden, my mind jumped to this podcast that I'm doing now and just like, ugh, this languaging pattern where people are inadvertently disempowering, or at least attempting to disempower. And again, it's not willful, but that is still how it's functioning, to disempower, to, you know, put a wedge in between the sexes, to insert the victim virus into a not class where it really doesn't belong, right? Took me, I don't know anyone else, but it took me out of the task at hand. And then for me, I had to use, you know, whatever degree of mental gymnastics it took for me to get back into the topic and just focus on knots. So when we're communicating, it's really helpful to avoid fragmentation. I've used the example quite a bit of the plural they used to describe a singular person, you know, for people who are playing the like very played, outdated pronoun game still. It's totally fragmenting to refer to a singular individual human with a plural pronoun, because it pulls the mind out of the topic at hand, because the mind has to make this very inorganic adjustment and do the translating. As far as the fragmentation piece, again, it was just our smartest move as speakers. You know, when I'm recording a solo podcast, as I'm doing now, is I want to keep you, the listener, engaged. I want to keep you in it with me and stay on topic as much as possible. Granted, you know, sometimes the Aquarian part of my brain will take us off into tangents, but I'm still doing my best to keep you with me in a continuous flow and not throw in these fragmenting, you know, record needle skips that are gonna send your brain off into a different direction, where it's gonna take way more energy for me as a speaker to wrangle your attention back to the topic at hand. Like, all of these are pieces that go into, I think, being an effective speaker or being an effective teacher, is keeping that topical momentum going. And so let me see if I know there's a part about fragmentation in the book. So let me do a quick pause so you're not going to be bored while I'm flipping, and I'll be right back. Okay, I found it. So fragmentation exists, shocker, in the identity chapter. And it was really only one page away from where I was, but okay, let's read about fragmentation. Hierarchy is fostered by fragmentation, a tool the social engineers use to divide and undermine the populace. Fragmentation fuels disaffection and incoherence, keeping us in a state of stuttering discordance, wherein flow, ease, harmony, and momentum evade us. We can think of fragmentation like a skipping record or a speed bump in the road. It's the moment the flow, it's that moment when the flow is interrupted by an unexpected hiccup or impediment that disrupts the momentum and pulls us out of our experience. As any athlete or high performer knows, momentum is pretty much everything, especially when it comes to achieving flow states. Fragmentation pervs our momentum by throwing a sudden wrench into the action at hand. As a social engineering strategy, fragmentation operates on multiple levels, dividing and dehumanizing while activating internal dissonance as a response to hiccups in flow, logic, and acculturation as a deliberate means of subverting and degrading our efforts to thrive, unify, harmonize, and evolve. Identification creates fragmentation, cordoning off our human family into smaller and smaller sections and groups, separating us from each other as well as our shared humanity in the process. Identification creates more us-them divides, confusing folks into forgetting that we are one human family who all bleed, laugh, cry, die, suffer, orgasm, giggle, and want the best for ourselves and our loved ones. The fragmentation identification foments is a massive impediment to unification. And then I shared this David Bohm quote that I am going to read us. Fragmentation is an attempt to extend the analysis of the world into separate parts beyond the domain in which to do this is appropriate. It is, in effect, an attempt to divide what is really indivisible. In the next step, such an attempt will lead us also to try to unite what is really not unitable. This can be seen especially clearly in terms of groupings of people in society, political, economic, religious, etc. The very act of forming such a group tends to create a sense of division and separation of the members from the rest of the world. That is the perfect explanation of what went down in that knot class, is it was separating women from the rest of the world. And there were some classes that I actually did want to take, not a lot, but like I did want to take a friction fire class. And when it was the one that worked time was friction fire for women, I was like, no way, I'm not down with sexism and bigotry, and I'm not going to take that class. I'm not into segregation. Like going back to inversions, the fact that segregation is now a progressive ideal, it's like so, it's just so cuckoo pants. So we really dialed that down to like such minute degrees of like this one little phrase, but it just felt, I wanted to share it with you because there was so much in it and I just wanted to unpack. Sometimes people think, you know, I've mentioned this before, oh, Dani, it's just semantics, like you're getting hung up about nothing, but look at on how many levels the deleterious frequencies in that little identitarian caveat was functioning and how much damage that was doing on so many different levels. All right, we're gonna move on to a different topic. That does it for the first half of today's solo podcast. As you are inspired to tune into the second half of today's podcast, which I'll give you a little hint, it's about the demonization of the high road. You can find that on both my Locals and Patreon communities. Those addresses are dannycats.locals.com and patreon.com/dannycats. At both communities, for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half conversations, plus oodles of bonus content, plus that warm, fuzzy, yummy feeling that comes along with supporting She, who writes books, makes videos, holds high-vibing interviews, puts out courses, aka me. Keep on keeping on. If you want to make sense of the way I just languaged that and why I did not define myself with any labels, which are boxes and cages that come along with so many damaging tributaries, I recommend signing up for the Law of Mankind course, which teaches us all about operating in the realms of law and lawfulness as sovereign men and women. It's a great way to help safeguard our lawful freedoms as various realms of tyranny, be they digital or analog, threaten to encroach upon our civil liberties and freedoms. Though clear, cancel, delete, I continue to hold the vision of a sovereign, empowered, united all of us. Anyway, you can click through the Law of Mankind link in this show description to sign up for that awesome course. Also reminding you that all of my books, Language of Betterarchy, Word Up, Pop Propaganda, and the newly re-released, new and improved, Extra Very Colorable, Yes I Am, are on sale through my website at all online book retailers, and make fabulous gifts for everyone you know and love. Last reminder, thank you for signing up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. And last reminder, wherever you're watching this, thanks for clicking that subscribe button, for liking, for sharing, for commenting. That does it. Thank you so much for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. I will see you over on the Locals and the Patreon. Have a rockin' day.